I am filling in for Bill and Wendy. They are on break, and they will be back on Tuesday, January 3rd, which, hey, by the way, is a 2017. So they'll be back next week, but I am here today and tomorrow filling in. But I'm not alone in the studio. I have the ever fabulous Kevin Richter, who is the producer today. He also produces for Bill and Wendy. He is helping me out, handy as ever. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? Have you recovered from the holidays?
Yeah, I was saying earlier, I'm kind of happy to be back, actually.
Okay, that's crazy.
Well, you know, you sit around the house so long, you kind of get a little stir crazy. I'm happy to be back and feeling productive.
Okay, well, I can say that I am super happy to be at WGN because I only sub from time to time for Bill and Wendy or Justin Kaufman. So I'm always happy to be at the WGN studio. But getting back to work, I don't know if I'm with you there.
Well, it's like I got a short week this week, got the holiday this weekend.
Yes.
Another short week. I can't be too upset.
Okay.
Things are going well.
Well, so that leads me to believe that you yourself did not host Christmas Eve or Christmas Day.
No way. I was driving around.
You were driving around. Okay, so this is what I did. For the first time ever, I hosted Christmas Eve. And I do have to say this is a family tradition. And if anyone has a family tradition like this, I hope that they will call in and tell me theirs. But so believe it or not, what we have done since, I want to say, the late 1960s, is one of the adults dresses up like Santa Claus, and we lead the kids to believe that Santa has landed. So what we do is, and I'm telling you, there's like 40 adults that do this. We tap on the windows and we say, oh my gosh, did you hear that? Oh, it's Santa's reindeer. They've landed. They're on the roof. Oh my God, look to the window. And all the kids, I'm going to say, ages 5 to 9, rush to the window, their noses to the glass. Then they're like huffing and puffing on the glass. And they're like, where's Santa? Where's Santa? Meanwhile, my grandfather or my nephew or my father, when he was alive, did it. He comes through the back door completely dressed as Santa. There's a pillow in his stomach. He's got the beard, the red hat, the suit. He's very roly-poly. We paint on white eyebrows. I'm telling you, we go down for the thing. Santa's in the house, literally. And for the kids, you know, if you're 7 years old or 6 years old, it's like what Britney Spears is to a 16-year-old, Santa is to a 6-year-old. And they start like hyperventilating, like, Santa's here, Santa's here. And we really play it up. Santa, we've stuffed a pillowcase filled with presents, and then, of course, all the presents under the tree. And Santa pulls out all the presents one by one for every kid. Have you been good? I've heard all about you. I know how special you are. Sit on my lap. Do you have cookies for me? Then we sing Santa some Christmas carols. I'm telling you, we truly go overboard. But here's the real weird thing. Sort of weird, I'll say. This year, there were no kids, 5 to 7 or 5 to 9. But the adults wanted to do it so much because we've been doing it since the 1960s.
So maybe you guys are the ones that actually get more excited. Maybe you're more excited than the children.
So we did it, even though there were no children. So my nephew was Santa this year, and he's a break dancer, and he was also a mascot for his university football team. So he came as like a break dancing Santa, and he pulled out the moves, and we were into it big time. So I'm going to say that I'm still a little teeny bit tired from Christmas Eve, but it was super fun.
That is really cool. My dad used to do that for my nephew too, but at a certain age they start to wise up and you got to be kind of careful with that. So yeah, we didn't do it this year.
Well, so it's because it's this family tradition. When you start to wise up, depending on what your parents tell you, so let's say between 9 and 11, give or take, when you start to wise up, then at least what we've done every year is say, okay, don't ruin it for the little kids. Don't ruin it for the little kids. And I remember when I was 9 and I was like, Santa looks an awful lot like Grandpa. And I started to put it together. And then the next year, I kind of held the secret for the little kids. So it's just fun. We love it. And we go into it big. We are big into Santa. And I'm still tired from it. So,
well, a breakdancing Santa is something to be excited about.
Know,
there's no doubt about that.
I know. Usually we have these black boots, but he came in his white Converse. And he was
hip Santa, yeah.
Totally hip Santa. That's what I was doing in East Rogers Park, everybody. But okay. Hip Santa's one thing, but now we've got hip Nicholas Baron in the house with me here in WGN Studios. Nicholas.
My white Converse.
And your white Converse. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So yeah. I want to say, Nicholas Baron is officially your name, but not to me. So since my name is Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth gets to say Sir Paul McCartney. And to me, I'm telling you, Chicago royalty, I call you Sir Nicholas Baron.
Oh my God. That's over the top.
I don't know. I don't know. Because I was making a list.
It's very sweet of you.
Over the years, I've seen you perform so many times. So yeah. I was making a list. I've seen you perform at Navy Pier, Martyrs, Buddy Guy's, Lincoln Hall, Shuba's. There was even this funky little place on Lawrence. I'm not even sure it still exists. It was kind of a pizza joint, but then it wasn't. Do you remember that bar I came to see you?
Man.
Under the L? Or no, maybe it was on Argyle.
I got there's a lot of them. I'm saying.
Yes, right. Okay, yeah, I know.
Over a long period of time.
This is what I mean, Chicago royalty. You have played every 30 clubs in Chicago?
Oh, God, no, way more than that. Well, over 30 years, it's been a lot of places. Yeah, a lot of places. Yeah. That's why I can't remember any of the names of them.
So give me a little bit of the history. How did you come to being a musician songwriter?
Wow. Well, my dad was a painter, and my mom is a writer and, you know, crazy person who loves art. And her record collection is what got me. Her record collection was mostly black artists. It was actually a mix of black artists, jazz artists, and soul and R&B mixed with, like, you know, Leonard Cohen and lyricist Bob Dylan. So I kind of have – so that's how I end up now, right? Whatever happens to your orientation. So my orientation was, you know, blues and soul and jazz, and then my mom would have these, like, folks who wrote lyrics and poetry, and she gave me a book of Lawrence Ferlinghetti's poetry when I was, like, 14. So that kind of changed my life, and I tried to, you know, I've always been interested in language, you know? So the intersection of those two things, I think, is kind of my, where I sit, you know, where I live.
And so you were saying you were influenced then by poetry early on, and, of course, your funky parents, which I think always helps.
Yeah.
So how do you go through the songwriting process? And I think specifically what I want to ask, because you don't just cover some songs from time to time. The majority of what you do is original music. How do you know when a song is good?
I think you spend time with it. You know, it's a relationship, you know, they're like your kids. Like, people say, what's your favorite song or what's your favorite record? And it's like, you don't have a favorite, you know, you like them differently, whatever. But I think a lot of it is playing, bringing it in front of people and how you feel about it. But the good ones tend to know that they're good. That sounds ridiculous, but they tend, you know, you just know it's a good song. And you know, when you're singing it, that it feels, I don't know, you want to sing it. You have a feeling for it that's positive and you know, you want to give it life.
So just, you feel that it's come together.
Yeah. I mean, every songwriter who writes, you have to write a lot of songs, a lot of really bad songs to come up with a good song. So I write a lot, but and then you get the gem and you kind of work on it for a while. I read this thing, Leonard Cohen, who just died recently, he would write 20 notebooks for a song.
Oh, gosh.
Which I think is tedious, but obviously the result is, you know, Suzanne and songs like that. But he would write 20 notebooks. Now, that's from this old thing called Songlines, this old newspaper from L.A. I think it was and interviewed people like every great songwriter that I loved. And that was this interview. And he, you know, 20 notebooks.
Wow, because the editing process there, the time to edit.
I do 19. 20 is like pushing
you
it.
You slacker. unfortunately, we're going to hit a break really fast. When we come back, we'll be back with Nicholas Baron. And there's a chance, people. There's a chance he's going to sing. So you might want to hang around. I'm going to hit a break, and here we go. The sounds of the soulful Nicholas Baron, who, hey, lucky for us, folks, he's in studio with me, and I think there's a pretty good chance he's going to sing maybe two songs even.
Ooh.
I know. Wow. I know. If he's not tired from Christmas Eve.
Oh, yeah. We have the same exact yearly, yeah.
You do?
No, but I do have 9-year-olds and a 12-year-old. The 12-year-old knows what's up. But she still goes along with it.
Of course.
But she goes along with it a little bit to not, you know, destroy for the 9-year-olds, but the 9-year-olds are... We need you guys to come over.
Oh, seriously?
We need to hire you.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that because my nephew is a hireable mascot. He goes around and he's a mascot for different companies that need
awesome.
A visual component to their logo. And so he should rent him out as a breakdancing Santa.
Rent to Santa. I'm sure that's a thing. I'm sure that's a thing. It's just born here.
I'm sure that is. And it's totally up my nephew's alley. So I am here with the ever fabulous Nicholas Baron, which I should say Sir Nicholas Baron to me. And maybe to you, people, as well. So walk me through. I'm always amazed. You know, so many of us struggle with I'd love to do this, but it makes no money, so I'm an accountant from 9 to 5. Not that there's anything wrong with being an accountant, but, you know, they have this other job that pays the bills, 9 to 5, yeah. But there's this hobby that they love, and here you've taken your love, and you make it work for you. Take me through a day in the life of you, a successful musician, and yet you haven't had, like, a pop charts money right. gushing thing, and you don't teach.
So, no, I do. I did start.
Teaching?
But I teach out. But I teach out of my home. But I teach songwriting. And
okay, yeah, so take me through a day, a life in the day of Nicholas, Sir Nicholas Baron.
Well, my thing is really spontaneity. So my life tends to be very improvised, and so I'm either because I'm a visual artist, so I'm either drawing, painting, writing songs. You know, obviously I'm on the phone talking, trying to get gigs or keep, you know, just keep those relationships going and trying to get more, you know, concerts and things like that. And it's a lot of work, you know, because it's not a structured. It's not a structured thing, you know. I'm dealing with, you know, within my cacophony. I call it pleasant cacophony. You know, I'm making things happen. But I do as much visual art as I do music, actually. Maybe even more on a daily basis. I draw every day, like many drawings. And it's sort of like my friend Monty Beauchamp came up with this word, divine affliction. I came up with affliction. He's like, divine affliction. If you're an artist, you have to do it, and you find a way to do it, and it doesn't matter. I've known this my whole life. You know, that I had to do it, and
you don't have a choice.
And you don't really have a choice. And I know that if you don't live it, it's hard for someone else to understand that. But it literally. I know I would not be who I was. I wouldn't be. You know what I mean? I wouldn't be who I was if I didn't do this.
You couldn't function.
I couldn't function. Yeah. And I wouldn't function. I wouldn't be happy. You know. And it definitely has saved me in a lot of ways. Or it definitely in makes me feel. It's a catharsis when I sing. It makes me feel. You know, better. And so many times I've been down and I sing and, you know, I sing blues a lot, which is blues, and it makes me happy, you know? So it's a very, it's amazing, you know?
I always think it's such an interesting dynamic with the artist because in some ways it is absolutely a point of privilege. You get to do what you love. And so many people, you know, everyone says, oh, the artists are so gifted, and they are, but there are so many among us who are doing the 9 to 5 who have a voice, who maybe sing or write or whatever, skate or whatever they do for their creative outlet, and they haven't been able to work that into their daily lives. And so I think the artist really comes from a point of privilege because they can do what they love and express themselves, the joy in expressing oneself and being heard and having that voice.
I think it makes your life, way more powerful. But I also think that it isn't like something that's given to you. Unless I didn't come from a trust fund, I didn't come from money. So I literally went to the subway just when I started, and I had no money, and I didn't have anything to fall back on to save me ever. And I think that what that does is it lights a fire under your butt. You know, you have to make money. When I first started, I would make $20 to $100 a day playing in the subway, and that was my, you know, that was my food for the day or
cash.
You know, cash. I mean, but I was so young and so naive that I could have, quote unquote, I could afford that, but I knew that I couldn't do anything else, and I knew I didn't want to do anything else. So it's not necessarily a privilege and it's gift, but it's what you do with it. You have to like a child, you have to embrace it and grow it and.
Well,
yeah.
So therein lies the dichotomy. In one sense, I think it is such a point of privilege. And in one sense, it's the hardest job on the planet because there's no
thank
security.
Thank you for saying that.
Oh, it is. There's no security. There's no stability.
No.
So you have a gig one night. Maybe that relationship falls apart. You never get that gig again.
Yeah.
You are constantly reinventing the wheel. And you do every job. You're the marketer.
Yeah.
You're the promotions guy. You're the guy who pays the bills and gets the gig. And, you know, then you write and you create and you produce and you edit. And, oh, my word.
Well, I think everybody in this world really has an affinity for something, comes into the world and are going to be, someone's going to be an ambulance, you know, be someone who works in an ambulance. Someone's going to be a doctor. Someone's going to be, I do think that we're drawn to things. Like, the sight of blood makes me ill, right? I mean, I would die myself.
For sure,
doing that job. That's not my.
You,
no, don't let me operate on you.
You're not the EMT.
No,
not,
not at all.
Okay.
No. So don't let me do that. But that's a gift, you know? And I feel like everyone has those. There's something they're drawn to. I'm not an electrician. I don't work in cars. I'm not. But, you know, that's you're drawn to it. And who knows where that comes from. But I do think, you know, I think that the thing you said that I never hear people say is that artists.
It's
you know,
hard.
Get looked at a lot as like, oh, I don't know what the ideas are, irresponsible or, you know, no, it's an incredible amount of work, like you say, because the structure is not there. It's not a 9-to-5 job. It's not a.
And you got to make that structure happen, whereas the rest of us live in structured lives already.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit of your gift. And right after the song, we'll go into break. But we're going to come back and talk more about how to be a successful artist, which I really consider you to be, because you live by your own rules and you make enough money to live and your family. So please, people, that's successful. But before we get to all that, after the news and break, sing us something good.
This is called Before the Fat Lady Sings. It's all about what we're talking about. I wrote this about being a street musician. I wrote it about the divine affliction of being an artist, and it goes like this. Well, I was struck with my affliction at a very early age, and I knew I had to make my music nonfiction, or I'd be like a panther in a cage. I had no one to show me what to do, so I started playing in the underground, just a Maxim House amp, high acoustic and a feeder. Through the filter of the blues, I started making sound. Cause this ain't no dress rehearsal. No, this is a real thing. No do-overs on rehearsal. You know, we can't wait till the fat lady sing. We can't wait till the fat lady sing. We can't wait till the call. Wait till the fat lady sings. We can't wait till the knockout bell rings. Knockout bell rings. Well, 8 hours a day in the church of the air. That's where I went to school to sing. I led a blues band and a jazz quartet, and I made more than enough money to live. And I know it sounds kind of crazy, but dudes in three-piece suits stood around listening, saying they wish they was me, cause I was following my heart, living the dream. That's what it means to be free. Oh, this ain't no dress rehearsal. No, this is the real thing. No do-overs on rehearsals. You know, we can't wait till the fat lady sings. We can't wait till the fat lady sings. We can't wait till the call for the second string. We can't wait till the fat lady sings. We can't wait till the knockout bell rings. Been doing this long time, and only where I played has changed. But I still see myself at Jackson and State, and I still hear them cats telling me I'm lucky. But now I know that luck is what you make. Luck is what you make, yeah.
Nicholas Baron playing live here in the WGN radio studios. I'm going to say, folks, that I just recorded that on my phone, so I'm going to put that on my Twitter if it'll take the two-minute video, and my Instagram, both of which are DinnerPartyCHGO, and it's also going to go on my Facebook page, which is Elizabeth Alfano. So you can check it there later if you'd like, because the awesome Nicholas Baron is in the house. We're going to go to quick break, and then we'll have news. Baron is in the house. I'm Elizabeth Alfano, filling in for Bill and Wendy. They're going to be back in 2017. That would be next week, just in case you were wondering. So Nicholas Baron is in the house, and that was going into the break there, coming out of the break. That was my very favorite Nicholas Baron song, Love Bus.
My mom's favorite.
Oh, God, I love that song.
Thank you.
So great to have you, Nicholas, here in the WGN studio. So right before we went to news and break and traffic, which now seems like forever ago, but we were talking about what it takes to be a successful artist. So a lot of people, you know, if you're super lucky, so not a lot of people, some people hit it big with a pop song, and so there's money coming in that way, or a lot of people go the teaching route. But for the longest time, you just did gig to gig to gig to gig. And so I'm wondering, what are the traits, according to you, to be a successful artist?
Well, I think the definition obviously depends on your life and where you come from. And for me, there was kind of never any question, because my parents are artists, and didn't have money. I didn't grow up with money. So I didn't have a father who was like, you're going to be a banker or whatever, you know. I never had any of that stuff. And it was kind of left to me to figure it out. And I went to music school, but I really didn't like school. I was never a school person, and I couldn't really focus well enough. And so I ended up just, you know, I think the last time I had a quote-unquote regular job was when I was 20, you know, so it's been a long time, 30
wow.
years.
Three decades.
Yeah, a long, long time ago. So this is all I've done. And it's, you know, it's work, but it's also, you know, it doesn't feel like work all the time. I mean, there are gigs that I'm like, oh my goodness, you know. But for the most part, that's one of the reasons why I'm trying to do concerts all the time. And of course, people that get to do that all the time, or some people win the lottery, so to speak, you know. But I think, and there are different levels, you know. But I also, about 8 or 9 or 10 years ago, started painting and drawing as much as doing music. So, which is another very lucrative profession. I'm kidding. but another thing that I just, you know, I come from a father who's a painter and a mother who does that. So for me, it was kind of like, it feels good. It feels obvious, you know, that I would do that. But yeah.
Well, so if you are now doing painting, how much of your time is spent painting and how much of your time is spent in music?
Well, you know, like I said, I draw more than anything at the moment. I'm setting up in we got, you know, 6 months ago, moved into a house with a garage that I can use as a studio. It's kind of like Jackson Pollock's.
Like Jackson Pollock.
Exactly. It's amazing. It's in the middle of the woods. No.
Well, so you mentioned that, but I'm going to say, and for those of you who don't know Nicholas's drawings and also paintings, I'm going to throw some up on my Facebook as well later today. So you can hit up Elizabeth Alfano on Facebook. But I'm going to say that you do have a Jackson-esque quality in that your artwork is so immediate.
Yeah. There,
it doesn't look like you're going from point A to point Z. It looks like it's all coming.
Nothing's planned. And actually, that's kind of how I live. That's how I write songs and a lot. And that's how I definitely do work, because I don't have a. It's definitely like improv. It's kind of like improv comedy. I mean, you just go with the one line leads to the next line, and it becomes its abstract expressionism. And my dad used to take us to the Whitney Museum in New York, and I saw, you know, Willem de Kooning. And Jackson Pollock, of course, and Arshil Gorky, and a bunch of big people who then, when, you know, I loved, but it didn't mean as much. And then when I started painting, it was like all this stuff started coming out, and my work kind of looks. I have an 8-foot painting at the City Winery downtown,
yes.
And that's a huge, almost like Lee Krasner, abstract expressionist painting, and it's called Autobiographical. It's for sale.
So for some of the people who are listening and maybe we're throwing around some names that don't mean much to you, let's just say that, and these are Nicholas's words, so this is not a slam. This is actually really how it goes. You started doodling, and you were a big doodler as a child.
My God.
And so it's just, if you can imagine people, and again, I'm going to throw these up on Facebook later, if you can imagine small doodles on a napkin, and you take that concept and you throw it magnified by like 100 times. And so it's doodle, 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 doodle that grows and expands. Sometimes there's color. Sometimes it's just black and white. It's that doodle that goes on to an 8-foot painting that, again, has that really immediate feeling.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, something that you like to say about yourself is that you feel, and this is a point of pride for you, and I would agree, that you're an artist who doesn't censor yourself. So tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I think, I just think the word artist in general, I think if you're an artist, there is a level at which you have to allow... You have to allow there to be what is there, and sometimes it's dark, sometimes it's light. But it's just to uncover. I when painting for me, because it's different than music in a lot of ways, because it's a different feeling, and yet somewhat it's some muscle group, so to speak. But you know, it's going with the flow and uncovering what may already be there. And yeah, the doodling. Because I was hyperactive. I don't feel as much like that, but my whole life I was hyperactive, and I couldn't sit still, and I literally would draw on everything productions. So, you know, and so when I transferred it to doing bigger stuff, it was kind of like I wanted it to look more like my heroes, you know, Willem de Kooning and stuff. So I took it a little broader my dad would sit with me and give me a little bit of advice, you know, and talk to me about balance and form. And he'd already told me that kind of stuff during my life with painting. But then I started using it. And it actually informed my songwriting, I think, too, and everything else, singing and performing.
Well, it's interesting how the two kind of play off each other. So you have music that informs the doodling, drawing, artwork, painting, and then that also informs the music.
Yeah.
I will say that, so Nicholas was saying, everybody, that he draws on everything. It's true. If you also want to go to my Facebook page, you can see the music video that I just videotaped. It's going to go on my page. You can see his guitar that he works on, that he's, you know, singing on. Every inch of it has... Is this out of magic marker? What
no, this is, this is a. They're called Art Deco. First, it was black, just black Sharpie oil paint Sharpie that I did in black, just black. I didn't lacquer it. It was not logical. I didn't like do it the exact thing that most people luthiers do, you know. So it, you know, it, some of it has rubbed off. A lot of it's rubbed off, and I started. Then I got an Art Deco color pen. I was in New Orleans, where I go a lot, and it just felt more festive, like confetti or whatever, you know. And now all my guitars, even my electrics, they're all, you know, have this kind of spontaneity.
I'm going to say that. There is something about your work, that immediacy, that it feels like confetti just coming out of your brain. Like all these thoughts and things, and all this energy just coming from your brain right to the page. So it's very
awesome.
Fun. But you mentioned, just one quickie question before we throw it a break again. You mentioned, you know, okay, all artists need to be open. And so in that sense, not censor themselves. But then there's also, you know, art has the commercial devil as well. And so I wonder how much of what you do in the back of your mind is saying, oh, I hope this one really hits it big. Or I'm going to push this piece or this song this way because I'm really hoping that it goes the commercial route.
Well, I'm doing currently a bunch of blues icon drawings. So they're 14 by 17 and they're going to be at the Elephant Room Gallery next to Buddy Guy's for the month of January. Because Buddy Guy plays Thursday through Sundays. I play there every Sunday. And so there'll be drawings of my, and maybe we can take a picture or whatever and put it up on the site too. But they're my drawings of Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Coco Taylor and, you know, on and on and on with my kind of, they're
Mavis
kind of look
Staples,
like folk art.
Please. Could
Mavis Staples, yeah. I haven't
Miss
done Mavis
Mavels
yet.
Got Miss
Mavis,
award yeah, last yeah. night.
Yeah.
Just a small one.
Just a small one, yeah. So that, yeah. So when I am thinking a little bit commercially with that, smaller things that people can take with them. You know, I do bigger things that are really more for me, that are, you know, some people may be able to afford, but they're a little more expensive and, you know, they're hard to put in your pocket. So.
Okay, so we're going to throw to break, but before we do, we'll say Elephant Room, next to Buddy Guy's, the month of January, and I'm guessing people could probably see them on your site as well.
Yeah, actually on Instagram
and
Facebook, I have...
Nicholas Baron.
Yeah, not on my website has... a link to it, but that's where you'll see my paintings. I have nicholasbaron.com/art, and you can see my a lot of paintings there. And stuff.
nicholasbaron.com/art. We're going to break, and we'll be back. The stellar beatboxes of Nicholas Baron, who's in the house, in the studio, WGN Studios. Nicholas, always so great to have you with me.
I love being with you.
That's so great. Okay, so right before we went to the break, we were talking about your career as an artist, a visual artist as well as a musician. So you, like 5 years ago, really got into being a visual artist, right?
Like almost.
Paintings, drawings.
I think it's more like 9 or 10, something like
oh,
that.
Oh, 9 or 10,
yeah,
okay.
It's been a minute.
So you started... Again, these are your own words, doodling. And that doodling just went to the next level and the next level. And you started doing larger and larger pieces of work, started doodling on your guitars, and then went to these large canvases. For those of us who maybe have a creative bent as well, but we just can't see how to really bring that to fruition, what kind of vision did you have for yourself that would allow you to say, yeah, I'm doodling on the back of a napkin, and I'm going to take this to the next level?
Well... In my case, I had a personal thing where it's a long story, but something where writing songs, I was kind of in pain. I was going through a big thing, and you know, usually songwriting and singing would help.
Yeah.
And my dad, I think I found a window or a couple old windows in the alley, and my dad gave me a canvas, and I started just using Sharpies, and then it turned, you know, evolved along the way into other things, acrylic paints, and now I use oil pastels, which are not. Pragmatic or not. It's more like I'm a graffiti artist in a lot of ways. I just try to...
It feels that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's how it evolved or how it grew from there.
Okay. So it wasn't necessarily a vision for yourself.
It wasn't. No, I wouldn't say, again, because I'm a very spontaneous person. It was really out of sort of need or out of an emotional place. I think for me, you know, I think that's for a lot of artists that I respect. I think it does come from that place, uh-huh. and not an intellectual place, but
and it just kept growing. From
yeah,
there.
And it kept evolving, and I kept on the road and the path, you know, so to speak. And
right,
yeah.
Well, okay, so then my next question is, we talked about a little bit before about how it's hard to be an artist. Everyone thinks like, oh, you've got to, you know, it's so easy. You lie on the couch all day and just pontificate about life. But of course, to make the ends meet and to sell that art and to connect with people, I mean, ultimately, the majority of artists want their work to be seen and felt, yeah. and they want some connection to who they're showing the artwork to. So you've got to make that happen and work. So that's a very hard part of being an artist. But another really hard thing, you know, most of us go through life trying to mask our feelings, trying to actually not feel that feeling or
right.
maybe not let it all hang out there for the world to see and hear what we're going through. I wonder if another hard part about being an artist is the self-doubt that must come. Like, sometimes you must wonder, yes. am I on the path? Or, you know, because you don't have any boss that's saying it's your three-month review time or we're going to, you know, so.
I wish there was.
Because you don't always have somebody pushing you to the next level. So
right.
how do you get through those periods when you doubt that maybe this isn't all
Of it's the unknown. Some of it is having faith and having trust in the process. And like, it is very difficult. I mean, we live in a culture where we grow up thinking about fame, especially now more than ever, since American Idol started 15 or 16 years ago. I mean, even more so. Fame becomes more valuable than the process. And for me, luckily, I'm a little older and I went through, you know, learning about the process. And when I didn't, it didn't. I've had a lot of close calls with, you know, fame or breaking through or big things happening, and they didn't happen. And I have to look at those as well. I guess it wasn't meant to happen. I wasn't in the right place for this reason or that reason. And other people win the lottery, like I said before. But I do think that, like, again, if you love it, you do it, and you have to do it. And for me, and this has been my way of doing it, is I came out of the subway, and I started playing 7 nights a week at every kind of place I could, restaurants and bars and places that were just great rooms. Or I would literally walk by joke amongst my musicians, I would see a Burger King, and I could play there. That's not true. I didn't play at Burger King.
Make that joint happen.
But, I mean, I made a living. I grew up poor. I wanted to make money doing what I loved, and it was that simple. And I ended up sort of, you know, I did that. That was my model. And I knew other people, friends of mine, who worked at the record shop and would only play their original music. And, you know, that has a lot of merit, but their experience and their background was different than mine. I wanted to play music all the time. And I wanted to make money from that. I don't know where that came from, other than the fact that, you know, like I said, I grew up with not a lot of money. So, and then it evolved and has evolved now to where I just pretty much want to do my own music as much as possible.
And I think you hit on a really important thing, is you have to believe.
Yeah.
You have to believe, honestly. I always say this in life in general, whether it's art or not. You have to believe and give. Otherwise, what's the point?
Well, the other thing is writing songs. And I think of myself a little bit in the place where Cat Stevens writes a song or mm-hmm. wrote a song. And it's social and it's personal and everybody relates to it. And I think with Trump becoming president soon, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to need. We're going to be entering a time where songwriters and artists are going to have that voice again, where there's an emotional... people are going to want to hear the truth, and they're going to want to hear, you know, they're going to want, we're going to, you know, talking about racism, talking about diversity, talking about love, talking about things that are very valuable, you know.
Well, we'd love to hear the truth here on WGN Radio. Would you like to sing us something?
Yeah. that was amazing.
talking about the truth here, Nicholas Barron's going to sing us something, and then sadly we're going to run to break, and that's the end of our hour together. So for everybody listening, I'll just say Nicholas Barron always plays Sundays, Buddy Guys.
Noon to three. Not this Sunday because it's New Year's Eve.
Right, okay,
but I'm
going to
be
sure.
there starting again the following Sunday. Yeah.
So you can always catch him live, Buddy Guys. Come on, how great is that? And then, of course, nicholasbarron.com/artwork.
Well, or just .com and music on one side and art on the other side. Yeah.
And you'll find it there. Take us away, baby. Right. What you got?
I'm going to play a song called Ain't No Woman from my latest record, and it's co-written with my friend Brad Taylor.
Met you downtown in the morning, fell in love by afternoon, but you said you was a rolling stone, and then you were just passing through. So I called you on the telephone, you're my own, my mind, and while the phone was ringing, I feel my temperature rise. Ain't no woman make me shiver. Ain't no woman make me ache. Ain't no woman in this whole wide world, only you can make the fever burn. I search for him day and night. I can't break a spell, and if I don't find you soon, there ain't no way that I'm getting well. Ooh, I thought I saw you on the South Train, with your arms around another man, and I ain't seen straight no more. Don't know how much more this I could stand. Ain't no woman make me shiver. Ain't no woman make me ache. There ain't no woman in this whole wide world. Only you, only you, only you can make the feeling break.
Nicholas Baron live in the WGN Radio Studios. We are over and out. We're going to break. Thank you, Nicholas. Thank you
so much, Elizabeth.
Those are the sounds of Nicholas Baron, who has just left our studio. And hey, folks, I'm Elizabeth Alfano, filling in for Bill and Wendy. They're going to be back next week, 2017. And Nicholas has left, and Jordan Moser is here. Artist, designer Jordan Moser, head principal of Jordan Moser Associates. Jordan, thanks for swinging by.
Thank you for inviting me.
So for those of us who might know, and I really have to include myself in this, explain to me, artist, designer, these are such huge, vague terms. Explain to me what you do exactly at Jordan Moser Associates. When I go on your website, I see you define yourself as storyteller, and I love this.
So I always like to read, and I started out at the Art Institute of Chicago studying painting and sculpture, and I studied a little bit of writing at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Then I got 2 degrees, one in product design and one in architecture at the University of Illinois. And we try and combine all of those different disciplines, which is a little bit unusual. We design a lot of restaurants and hotels, and we usually start with a narrative, a story that comes from a way to describe the project or the client or the site, and then we riff on it. And so we take a narrative idea, and then we turn it into sometimes a building and an interior. And we try and use the discipline to also design every component in the space. So it's kind of like walking into a fantasy that always relates back to the story. And we design and manufacture the chairs and the lights and even the door handles and the sculptures in Chicago.
This is why, and I mean this lovingly, and I hope it is taken in this way. Every time I go into one of your properties, and there's a huge list of things that you do in Chicago and, of course, around the world, and I'll name those in a minute in case anybody wants to go in and experience what I experience, which is whenever I go into one of your properties or projects, I experience Jordan Moser the ride. Because I feel like I've just entered into a completely different world.
That's part of the idea. I think that reality can be a little harsh sometimes, and that the best restaurants and hotels are an escape from reality and their own world, and they have their own logic, the logic of a dream or a poem, and some idiosyncrasy, which is sometimes missing in the real world. And so it's an escape from reality.
Exactly. So let me just list here some of the places. Some of these have closed in Chicago, but of course, new restaurants are always opening. So you designed Scusi, which is one of my, truly that took you to Italy. So people might remember this back in the day. Oak and Char, which I loved, I think recently closed, but I loved, was right there on Superior. Cairo, the Cairo Bar at Superior and Wells. Oh, that takes me back. Hudson Club. You also designed Wow Bao, Vivere, Coco Pazzo, Cheesecake Factory. And those are just places in Chicago. And of course, you have places literally all over the world, Thailand, the East Hotel in Germany. You've also done work for George Lucas.
Once upon a time, we were working with Bill Kempton, who was a hotel innovator in San Francisco, who said he invited us out there because we'd worked on Scusi with Rich Melman of Let Us Entertain You here in Chicago. And it was a destination upscale casual restaurant. And Bill Kempton had the idea to invigorate hotel lobbies by basically taking the idea of an upscale casual restaurant and adding rooms, a place to sleep. And one of his folks left to work with George Lucas, and they invited me up there. And there was there were some dead shopping centers. And George Lucas asked the question, he said, can we revive the shopping centers by creating entertainment centers? Instead of going to a shopping center to do your work every day, getting milk and getting air conditioning filters, what if you went there for fun? What if you went there for food and beverage and for jazz and for things that you want that you didn't need, kind of impulse retail? And we worked on that idea, and then the recession caught up with California, and we took the idea and played with it at Universal Studios and with the Imagineers at Disney. But the place where it really kind of exploded was when we started working with Steve Wynn in Las Vegas at the Bellagio Hotel.
Yeah, what I love about this, so to start these kind of projects where you indeed tell a story, you work with some very creative people, not just out in your own office, obviously, because you, Jordan Moser Associates, are all creatives, but you're working with people who have come to you because they want to do something completely out of the ordinary. So they're turning these questions about a regular old shopping mall and they're making an experience center, or the grocery store where you have things maybe that people, rather than products organized by how the grocery store buys the products, it's more how people think about food and how they create food together. For example, I find it very difficult to go shopping in a grocery store. I think the whole thing is laid out poorly and illogically for me. So you're working with people who want to create a world and think about it differently.
Sometimes it's about cross-pollination and taking ideas from one discipline and applying them to another, which was, like we said, we're talking about before, the boutique hotels that are now quite a craze 30 years later. And that was an idea about upscale casual dining, which was in itself an innovation at its time. So we have had the opportunity to collaborate with a lot of really exciting innovators, both in the studio and in business.
Yes, and you've worked with some really creative businesses, Barney's. You've also done things for Mick Jagger. And so it must be really fun to have this different impulse coming in every time you have a new client.
It is. And that's where the narrative stuff comes from. We start to jam with an innovator, a business person, an entrepreneur, and then we try to abstract it so that we can be playful with it as opposed to taking things too seriously. We create a story that tells the idea of our client, the kind of a portrait of our client, and then we start riffing on it, and it creates it allows us to test the continuity and the quality of our solution.
The world according to Jordan Moser. We are going to head to break, and we'll be right back with Jordan Moser.
Yeah.
We are back here with Jordan Mosier in the WGN Radio studios. Jordan, always great to have you with me. So you were talking to me during the break about some of your past projects, and I was saying, to me, I think of Jordan Mosier objects and furniture as having a very distinct style. So I would say fluid and animated, but you were saying, not so fast, because it depends on the project. And how, again, going back to, you really want to be a storyteller. So it really depends on what the client wants, but also the story that you're building around the project. So I know you've had some fun projects in the past that involve pigs' shapes.
One of our most exciting projects was in San Francisco. And there's a chef named Charlie Trotter. He introduced me to his friend John Cunin when I was flying back and forth to work with George Lucas. And John Cunin had run restaurants for many years, and he wanted to open one that celebrated the very creative food and wine coming out of Northern California that was seasonal and regional. And the site that he found for his restaurant was right next to City Lights Bookstore. And we were looking for imagery that was American. And we looked around at the taverns that were in the neighborhood, which were from the 40s. And at City Lights Bookstore, Lawrence Ferlinghetti had published Jack Kerouac, and one of my favorite books is On the Road. And in the book On the Road, the characters drive a 48 Hudson across the United States at 90 miles an hour, stopping only for jazz and apple pie. And we thought, that's American, and that's optimistic. And we kind of crossbred this 48 Hudson with these old taverns from the 40s that were in the neighborhood and came up with the Cypress Club. And that project, everything was pudgy. And so we had to make everything fat. We decided that we'd make everything fat. And that wasn't easy because most of the materials are flat. And we succeeded in doing it. We did it by making everything from scratch in Chicago and shipping it out there. And San Francisco is quite a tourist town. It generated projects for us in Japan and Germany and in Hollywood and then Las Vegas. And when I got to Germany, I told them the story about the pig and the inspiration, the fat project. And they said, well, if you're feeling lucky here, you say, I have a pig. And ever since then, I've signed my name with a little pig.
So that's Jordan style.
That's Jordan style. So recently we did some restaurants in Los Angeles, and our client is a surfer. And that project has no curves. And the project involved designing an iPad to allow guests to be chefs and to design their own sandwiches and salads and pizzas. And so it's kind of, we're channeling the celebrity chef idea, and we wanted to create an environment where people felt creative, and so we created kind of a loft space, which is very unusual in Southern California. Stuff's new, as you know, being yes. a new California resident.
Yes.
And we built, we had a budget for plywood cabinets, and we said, do we have to build them out of plywood? And they said, no, you can build them out of anything you want as long as they're functional and they are within the budget. And we built them out of steel, and they're steel boxes with big, massive hinges. And we gave the legs, we made the legs out of wood, and we created kind of a portrait of our client wearing surfer shorts because he grew up surfing. And so it referred to all the concepts for the project.
What I love about the way you work is when someone says designer or artist, you immediately think, okay, maybe they've designed a lamp or maybe they've done a painting. But actually, you're talking much more about large-scale concepting rather than, I mean, you do the product formation as well. You know, like you say, every doorknob, every lamp, every table and furniture and chair. But you also are really concepting the experience. And I think that's what's so interesting. And I'm guessing that's why a lot of clients come to you.
We've been very lucky. We had a project in outside of Minneapolis, and there was a field there. We sketched the field, and the sketches of the field generated some forms that were rolling. The prairies were rolling, and there were crops and stands of trees, and we abstracted those and turned those wavy forms into a building, clad it in copper when the copper prices went down. And we made the light fixtures out of 36,000 test tubes dropped through perforated metal. And because I associate Minnesota with the Mayo Clinic and the work they did for my mom when she was wasn't feeling well. We have a project that is a hotel and restaurant in Hamburg, Germany. And it was an old foundry. They wanted to create a Asian fusion restaurant. And we tried to make everything using foundry techniques or foundry images. Everything was cast. And as opposed to doing any specific Asian imagery, we created the feeling of a Westerner in Asia for the first time, a little bit of surrealism.
Great, because I think that's how most people going there experience it, of course. So, yeah. Well, so I know you can't talk about projects that you currently have going on now. That's sort of your policy. So we've been talking about a lot of previous projects, but you do have some very new news that I'd like to talk about. So you just opened, after 33 years in River North, you opened a new studio in West Loop.
We are.
You are in the process. It's pretty open, isn't it?
It's open.
Up and running. Yeah.
We have a new website, which is mozer.com. And we have a new gallery that my wife, Karen, has put together along with my business partner, Jeff Carlos. And it has a lot of the leftovers, the products that we created for all these restaurants and hotels and entertainment projects. We started selling them. First, we started at auction with David Drago Auction on the East Coast and with Wright Auctions here in Chicago. And we just opened the gallery a couple weeks ago. And we've been inviting people by to take a look at some of the pieces that come from the projects. We had always been very project-focused. Yeah. And Karen said when we were moving to this new studio at Laughlin and Carroll, she said, you know, we have too much stuff, so let's get rid of it. I said, well, I can't throw this stuff away. She said, well, then let's start to sell it. I said, I guess we could do that. I'd never thought about doing that before.
What I love about this is it's the first time in 33 years that your studio has now been open to the public. So things that one might find when they're there, as you say, you have the gallery. So your works, your art, your sculpture, and then things that have been left over, not left over, but one-offs from projects. So if you did 80 chairs for a restaurant, maybe you made 84 just to be sure you'd have enough, and then you have 4 chairs left over. So you have this, people now have this opportunity to have Jordan Mosher design in their own house. And that might be anything from, because I've seen them, wonderful works. That might be anything from, let's say, paperweight size to, again, lamps, tables, chairs, drawings, and more.
Yeah.
Now, do you have any other outside artists? When you say gallery space, is it something that you invite outside artists to, or it's just Jordan Mosher designs?
It's really stuff that's created by the studio, which is Karen and I, Jeff. The kids have been starting to contribute. They're all artistic.
Yes, and I'll say that you have 3 girls in college, so
yes.
You have been quite successful at your endeavor. You're able to put 3 young ladies through college, and they're all following the arts as well. They all have a very creative bent.
We take off the week between Christmas and New Year's, and the kids were all at the studio yesterday, and Chloe was making books, and Isabel was doing some embroidered drawings with thread, and Eliza was doing some illustrations for her artwork.
Such an incredibly talented clan, because, of course, you mentioned your wife, partner in life and partner at Jordan Mosher Associates. So Karen Lily Mosher is a very talented designer in her own right. And I think I have to give credit where credit is due. She is the one who wanted to start, like you said, selling things to the public, having some sort of outdoor presence or open presence to the outdoor world, and your renovated website, which is so exciting. So if anybody wants to visit, how do they do it? Just go to your website and
go to the website and send us an email and ask for an appointment.
Wonderful. And then you do have, as you said, these galleries. So you have some hours that are open to the public?
Or? It's by appointment.
By appointment only.
And during
special.
The weekdays, we're open. Yeah.
Wonderful. So at Mosher.com, M-O-Z-E-R. Jordan Mosher, I am sorry it is so quick. Gosh darn it.
It was fantastic seeing you. Welcome back to Chicago. I hope you have a great time.
I'm loving it. I'm loving being at WGN, seeing all my friends, and it's cold here, people. It's cold, but I don't mind. I don't mind. Jordan Mosher, thank you for being here. Mozer.com, folks.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
One night I kissed Anna Nicole Smith. She tasted like pickles and America.
Hey, everybody. I'm Elizabeth Alfano. I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy. They'll be back on Tuesday. Those are the luscious sounds of none other than Margaret Cho, comedian, actress, singer, and songwriter, because you maybe didn't know that. And I'm going to say the patron saints of outsiders. Margaret Cho joins us by phone from Los Angeles. Margaret, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great, great. It's so good to have you here joining us. I am a fan. I got to tell you, I am a big fat fan.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, congratulations. Your fifth nomination for a Grammy for American Myth. How good does that feel?
Oh, it's awesome. It would be great to win. this is the fifth nomination overall, fourth in this category. And it's really something that I'm really proud of. I mean, it's the highest honor you can get in this particular industry. Comedy, we really get very excited about this award.
And you say comedy, and of course it is comedy, but it's musical comedy, I'll say, in the sense that people maybe don't know this, but you are a singer-songwriter. The entire album is songs that you've written and sometimes composed, and you certainly sing and perform. So what got you into songwriting? And, I mean, you're obviously still a comedian, but what got you sort of into songwriting?
I just love it. I've been around music for as long as I've been around comedy. This is 34 years on now, and comedians and musicians shared life. We're always out, and I always would do a show and then end up at a music show after that. And just talking to musicians, talking about how similar our work is. And the comedians always want to be musicians, and musicians always want to be comedians. And so there's this bond that is really electric. And so I started doing this about 10 years ago. In 2010, I had another album come out called Codependent, which also something that I love and will always do.
I think we lost you there for a minute, but we've got you back. That's right. Codependent came out quite a while ago, and I think you were also nominated for a Grammy for that as well.
Yes, which is great. And that one received two nominations, one for the actual album itself and the next year for the live show. So it's a different kind of category because they do focus on musical comedy and also stand-up comedy shows. So it's great.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is so fascinating to me about American Myth, which I also love, and I'm not surprised that it is nominated for a Grammy, is that, and herein lies the beauty of comedy, in that you touch on incredibly difficult subjects, sexual abuse, feeling bullied, feeling ostracized, coming out, even struggling with weight. I think at some point you call yourself fat, which I'll say for the record, since you and I have had lunch together and we plowed through an enormous amount of food, you're not fat, but it was yummy, but you're not fat, but certainly all women have weight issues and constraints and concerns. And so you're addressing all these really hard issues in American Myth. And I'm wondering, how good does it feel to be able to get out that cathartic rage and then have it be acknowledged, not just for what you're saying, but for the work itself?
Oh, it's so fantastic. And I'm just so honored. And also being fat, like I have to say, I'm not really fat, but I'm Hollywood fat. And I'm in Asia, I'm like Guinness Book of World's fat. They've never seen a larger Asian than me. So I'm very, very large in comparison to my people. I'm one of the people who drink milk. I'm much bigger than most Asian people. Well, but I'm very proud.
But you bring up kind of an interesting point. So I think of you, Margaret, one of the reasons you have such a large following is because you really live your life, I want to say, almost in technicolor. I mean, you just don't hold back. And I'm wondering, after years of speaking out and being so vocal in your comedy, in your own personal life, and in your music, does it get any easier to live life without fear?
I think so. You get used to it. I mean, I'm 48 now, and when you get to my age, you just don't care.
I have to say, it's like the one great benefit of growing old is you just sort of say, like, oh, yeah, I just don't care. There's only one benefit, and it's I'm not going to be bothered with that anymore.
Yeah, and that's a great feeling. And fortunately, I have said in my work for myself as a younger person, but now I really live it and feel it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So let me get back to American Myth here just for a second, and then we're going to have to go to a quick break. How hard is it to make the horrible funny? I'm speaking specifically about sexual abuse, because you've come out about being sexually abused when you were younger, and how tricky is it to make that somehow lighthearted, and yet not lighthearted at all?
Well, you have to be able to laugh, and you have to be able to heal. Laughter is healing. Humor is just a coping mechanism, ultimately. And so it becomes part of you. It becomes reflective. And that's just what I do and what I always do.
Yeah, and I think, again, therein lies the true beauty, I feel, of American Myth. Okay, and there's so much more to talk about with Margaret Cho, and we're all going to do that, people, when we get back from a break. We'll be back with Margaret Cho. Not sure if you would have guessed it, folks, but those are the sounds of Margaret Cho. Her album, American Myth, has been nominated for a Grammy, and she joins us here by phone from L.A. Hey there, Margaret.
Hello.
So I'm glad you're back. Seems like our connection's a little bit stronger this time. I wanted to talk to you again a little bit more about American Myth and just the way you approach your creative process. You've been through some really tough things in your life, again, as a kid being bullied and ostracized for being Korean and being different, and then coming out and about your gay life, and then even sexual abuse. You've lately talked about that. I'm wondering if you have any advice for people that might be going through something similar, something that helped you that might help them.
For me, channeling my pain into art and doing comedy and making music and doing something that directly relates to my issues, but at the same time gives me a sort of a big, horrible thing happens, but I can take this and use this as a story to help others, things that I can create with. I think whatever you do, channeling this suffering into something beautiful has always helped me.
Yeah, I think that is great advice. I think so many of us don't do what you do, which is we don't sort of live our lives on the surface like that. You live your life so raw, and most of us are covering the pain. But I think anything, like you say, you can do to confront oneself, really, and be able to get those feelings out in the end, tough as it is, in the end, it is cathartic.
Yes, it's true. And you can't cover up anything. Can't cover it up. You have to use it and release it somehow, or else it really, it's very corrosive, and you can really, really feel like that you can't do anything.
Right. It will kill you. I know that sounds extreme, but covering it up will, in the end, just eat you away until there's not much left of a soul. But I wonder,
yes,
when you're creating, do you focus on this? So when you're creating a song, do you think, I have these feelings and I'm getting them out? Whether anybody listens to it or not, that's another thing. Or do you say, no, I really have a message and I want to strike a chord with anyone else who's been suffering? Or do you chuck all that and just say, let's hope for the commercial success?
Well, you really go for it with a mind to help others, and that itself is the reward. That is the success, when you can actually do something and make something very hopeful for people, helpful for people. That's the greatest success.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely agree. And therein, I think you have been so rewarded. And again, I love to see somebody living their life so raw and on the out front to everyone. And you have been rewarded for that. I'll say bravery. You have been rewarded because you are a patron saint for outsiders. And I look at your Twitter feed, and it's so fun to watch your Twitter feed. And people really do, I think, thank you, love you for speaking out. And that's wonderful to see.
I'm so grateful for that. And social media has been wonderful in getting that kind of response and getting that feeling like, oh, I'm really doing something good, so I'm really proud.
Well, so I'll turn the conversation and go a tad bit lighter and talk about, hey, the Fashion Police. You have been on E! And you aren't there all the time, I think. You just kind of come in for special occasions. And I think one of those special occasions is going to be the Golden Globes on January 9th.
Yes, we have a great season plan for award shows. It's time of the year for fashion. You get to see all of the great designs out on the red carpet. The red carpet is really a theater. It's like a court in the 17th century in France. You know, everybody, there's so much. It's fabulous.
Yeah, I will say, because I've done so many red carpets myself, I will say that it is kind of theater of the absurd, and it's so fun, and the energy is so high, and lights and flashes, and people are moving so quickly, and what people don't see on a red carpet is that behind that celebrity is usually their PR person saying, like, move it along, shut up, that's enough, no more questions from you, go, go, go. So it is kind of a pure chaos. Well, good. Okay, yeah. So we can look for you January 9th. On E for the Fashion Police, you're going to be covering the Golden Globes. And again, sort of just to highlight you, I never really thought of you as a fashionista per se, but I will always say that the best beauty tool ever is self-confidence. And that, baby, you've gotten spades.
Thank you. And I love fashion. I do. It's just something, I come from a different angle. I'm a seamstress. So I come from the construction and the seams and the bare bones of what makes a dress and what makes the red carpet show. I love it.
Well, you shine there as well. So I'll look for you January 9th, Golden Globes. You'll be covering it at the Fashion Police on E. And of course, as I said, I'm a fan, so I'm rooting for you. In February, we have the Grammys. Margaret Cho's album, American Myth, is nominated for a Grammy. So come on, Lucky 7. I want you to get it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to have you here, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
Bye, Margaret.
Bye.
Oh, Kevin, that was so fun. I'd love to have Margaret Cho in the house.
She's great, yeah.
She is great. We had a tricky bit of a connection there, so it was a little bit, you know, cell phones. Everyone says, technology is the best thing on the planet, but every once in a while, it doesn't come through 100%.
Well, there's a lot of miles in between these two phones, I take it.
Fair enough. She is in L.A. So we are just about to wrap up here, but before I do that, I will ask you, do you have any New Year's Eve plans?
I'm hosting some friends. My friends and I actually have been doing for about 10 years. Well, this is the 10th year anniversary. We do something called the Beer Exchange. So as opposed to getting together and giving each other gifts, we all just bring a six-pack of craft beer and we can, you know, have a free-for-all. So we're doing that.
Well, I will not be going to your party, but maybe I will donate to your party because my very favorite beer. This is why I come back to Chicago. So people maybe know as I fill in for Bill and Wendy and I fill in for Justin Kaufman, I spend a lot of time in Los Angeles doing a lot of work there. And of course, my home and my family and where I live and my work is also in Chicago. So I'm back and forth all the time. One of the reasons I come back to Chicago is Matilda.
It's good stuff. You're right. Yeah.
And I try to get it elsewhere. I mean, I hunt that stuff down. Cannot find it.
No
I can barely
kidding.
Find it in Chicago. For the love of God, I feel like sometimes they're trying to hide it from me because I buy it in bulk. I mean, I love that stuff.
Goose Island has a lot of those exclusive beers, like that Bourbon County Stout, too, is impossible to find, and people spend a lot of money for it.
It's amazing, and I like to get – I love how they package it, too, so I like to get it in the big bottles.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if you'll have Matilda at your party.
It'll probably be there or something along that vein.
So you're doing it at your house?
Yeah. We're hosting it at my place this year. So it should be fun. It's the 10-year anniversary. We were children when we started doing this.
I love that. Wow. Okay. So party everybody. Everybody on WGN Radio.
Party at my
place. Kevin Richter's
house.
Come
on out. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It goes so fast. I so love being here at WGN Radio, and I love subbing for Bill and Wendy, and the time does really slip by. But we'll be back tomorrow here from 10 to noon. I've got some great guests coming on tomorrow as well, singer Steve Dawson and gallerist Aaron Packer, and then we have the chef from the Palmer House Hotel. So it's going to be a very spicy, luscious show tomorrow. Catch it from 10 to 12. And right now we're going to hit a break and then go to news.